This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Konstantin von Hofmeister, and we're going to be discussing the geopolitics of the Iran war. Konstantin, great having you on.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
I think a good place to start is like the cause of the war, because I think the strong narrative is that it's a war, basically a war for Israel because of the different things where Jared Kushner, the Adelsons, Netanyahu were pressuring this war. And Netanyahu likely gave Trump bad intelligence that the war against Iran would be easy. And I think there's a strong argument for that. But at the same time, like, there is a bit of like an anti-Semitic element or argument about that, because I think at the same time, I do think there is strong validity to the argument, but I do have some critique where I think people who blame it entirely on Israel getting us into the war, I feel that that takes away agency for Trump, because obviously, like, even I get this, like, I have some degree of respect for Tucker Carlson, but even I get this from him. Like, he sort of blamed it on maybe on Israel, but like Trump is somehow, was somehow like less culpable, because I think at the same time, some of the anti-Semitic narratives, like, they take away agency from American politicians. So there is some degree of nuance, but I do think, I mean, there are different factors, but I do think Israel is one of the main factors for this war. Konstantin, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, definitely. Well, I think Israel is definitely the main factor. And if you when you ask about the reasons for the war, and it's not even clear, right? Because the Trump administration,
he didn't do. It's interesting is like when we went after 9/11 happened, we went to Afghanistan and Iraq. Like, there was this massive propaganda campaign. Trump didn't even do a propaganda campaign to morally justify it and make a case why we have to. He basically random.
Yeah, well, exactly. Well, that was my point. They keep changing the goalposts. They keep saying different things. Like, what? Like, because if you ask them, like, why exactly did you attack Iran together with Israel? What's the purpose of the attack? Like when it happened at the end of February, I mean, I was I just woken up. I'm here in Germany, and it was like, I don't remember, like 7 or 8 in the morning, and it was like Israel bombing like certain sites in Tehran. And I was like, oh, okay, right, I guess it's starting. And then, well, soon after, the Americans joined in, and they immediately went all in. And well, then they killed the schoolgirls, right? Which, in my opinion, is completely messed up and unforgivable.
Do you believe it's intentional? Because Iran's argument was
it doesn't matter,
intentional.
Though. It does not matter.
Because
what happened? The attack was completely unprovoked. Like, what did Iran do? Didn't do anything, right? So they were Iran was in the middle of negotiations with the United States. And the United States, together with Israel, attacked Iran during the negotiations. Like, it's completely fucked up. And then they basically killed like almost 200 schoolgirls. Like, they hit a school, and it was apparently a double tap, right, with Tomahawk missiles. And then after it happened, like, the Trump administration wouldn't even admit it. They said, no, we didn't do it. The Iranians did it.
Oh, yeah, Trump said
it
was...
The Iranians couldn't have done it. They don't have any Tomahawk missiles.
Yeah, of course not. That was pretty disgusting, what Trump said, yeah.
Yeah, and to this day, it's like over 2 months ago already. To this day, they have not accepted responsibility for this attack. And this alone discredits the entire Trump administration forever. Like, this act alone is completely beyond the pale. Like it matches like the worst war crimes that happened in Vietnam, in my opinion. And it's completely unacknowledged, not only by the Trump administration, but also by Western media. I mean, Western media mention it. Like, I remember, like, when I looked at, like, some news sites in Germany, like, but it's how they framed it. It was not, like, headline news. It was, like, on the side somewhere. And it didn't say, like, United States hits school in Iran and kills 200 children. It actually said something like, Iran claims that the US did this and that. So it's the framing again. It's like basically it made the audience think, maybe it didn't really happen. Maybe the Iranians are making it up. I mean, it's now proven beyond the shadow of a doubt that it happened and that the Americans were 100% responsible for it. But the fact that the administration doesn't even acknowledge it, it's just plain evil, if you ask me. And it really puts like a really, really, really black stain on the entire Trump administration, especially Trump and Hegseth. Yeah, I mean, really, it's a grade A war crime, no matter what you say. And it's not only that. I mean, they hit civilian targets left and right. It was
I think
basically
another thing that
basically.
is important to point out is there was some degree of a propaganda campaign about like human rights abuses, and that looks totally bullshit
Total
considering
nonsense.
of the
Same.
total nonsense bombing the civilians. But it was interesting thing. I mean, and terror obviously terrible is the U.S. and Israel are bombing civilians in Tehran. Like that's the demographic that's the most secular,
Well,
cosmopolitan,
I
and
just.
anti-regime. So it makes no sense whatsoever. I think, like, there's some talk of regime change, which obviously is bullshit. But I think with the Israelis, I think they just want Iran as a total failed state. They don't even want like a more secular regime. I think Netanyahu
Well,
just wants Iran totally
they
destroyed.
want to be the only regional power,
Yeah.
basically. They want to get rid of the only serious regional rival, which has always been Iran. And Netanyahu has been saying for over 20 years that Iran is only a week away from the nuclear bomb. First of all, my question is, why is Iran not allowed to have a nuclear bomb anyway? Like, why does everybody think it's normal that Iran is not allowed to have a nuclear bomb? Why shouldn't they have a nuclear bomb? Iran has nuclear weapons. Everybody knows it. Like, why is it, why, sorry, Israel has nuclear weapons. Why is Israel allowed to have nuclear weapons? United States has nuclear weapons, and the United States is the only country that used nuclear weapons, atomic bombs, not just once, but twice on civilian cities. So why are these countries allowed to have nuclear weapons, but Iran is not allowed to have a nuclear weapon? It makes no sense to me because
Well, it
nowadays,
would.
as everybody knows, I mean, there's a reason why North Korea was never attacked by the United States, and it is
All
because
right.
they have a nuclear weapon. If Gaddafi had a nuclear weapon, he would probably still be alive and ruling Libya, and the same with
He
Saddam. I mean,
cooperated by giving up all his
literally,
weapons.
the only security guarantee against the United States and Israel and its allies is NATO in general is to have a nuclear weapon. It's the only deterrent that works. So, I mean, and I think the United States is achieving the opposite now because if the Iranians agree to not have nuclear weapons, they'd be stupid. I think they'd probably do anything now to actually get a nuclear weapon so this
Yeah,
kind
I guess
of attack won't happen again.
the argument is, well, there is, if Iran were to get a nuclear weapon, there would be like an escalation where Saudi Arabia would, Turkey would,
Well, and why
but there is, but
not?
the
Why
thing is, like, there is like this
why
idea
should
of mutual.
why shouldn't these countries have nuclear weapons? I think Israel should be the first country to give up its nuclear weapons because Israel is literally the only threat in the Middle East. It's the number one aggressor country in the Middle East.
So
It's number
there
one.
is the whole concept of a mutual self-destruction where a country where actually nukes, because a lot of leftists want total nuclear disarmament, but there's a counter argument that nukes maintain peace because
Obviously.
it prevents war because of mutual self-destruction.
Right.
So I disagree with the lefty peaceniks on that, but I guess the neocons are saying that Iran has a suicidal like ideology where they would use a nuke and destroy themselves for some apocalyptic cult. But I think that's bullshit. Like, I don't think that, I mean, they're not like these like Salafist groups like Al Qaeda. I think that's total bullshit.
I mean, Iran is Shia. and it has a 3,000-year-old culture, like it's a civilization state, right? If you look at it, say from a multipolar perspective, a civilization state is basically a civilization, so unified people, common background, common culture, common language, common heritage. That's what makes a true civilization. So, but it's also a state. It's a sovereign state. And you can say the same about the Islamic world in general, especially the Sunnis, I suppose, because
Like the Gulf monarchies.
they're all fragmented, right? And
And they were
they're
instilled
not
sort
really
of
unified.
arbitrarily by the end of the British Empire.
So it's a civilization, but it's not a state. It's not a unified state like South America, like after Trump kidnapped Maduro. I mean, I didn't see a lot of resistance in South America, in Latin America, against this act of aggression, which it
Because
clearly was,
Venezuela, like
right?
Venezuela is not. Like it's a colonial society that's very deracinated, and they lack
Well,
that
obviously,
cohesive
right?
identity.
But well, I just wanted to make the point that there's no that there's no united front. There's no united Latin American front against the United States. So, I mean, there was not even any real resistance inside Venezuela, because now the new Venezuelan government is negotiating happily with the United States, and they have United States representatives in the country as we speak.
I mean, I was against the Venezuela invasion too, but I mean, that actually was successful. But Trump was so delusional that he was convinced that he could replicate that in Iran. Because, I mean, I think it's because he does no, he's a businessman. He has no understanding of geopolitics or philosophy and history.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I was just actually discussing this with a wife earlier today, exactly the same thing. We're discussing Maduro, and I also think it was super successful. And it was like a movie, right? Like a James Bond movie. Like similar to like the when they what's his name? The German SS guy who rescued Mussolini from the Allies. Scorzeni, Otto Scorzeni. He rescued Mussolini, right? During World War II. It was very similar, like just really like a Hollywood movie. Yeah, super successful. I completely agree. Yeah, and I also think that, and my wife said, but why? Why didn't he just leave it at that, right? It was so successful. It was such good marketing for the United States. Look how effective the United States is, the military. Look what they can pull off. It was just beautiful, like a commercial, right? But then he had the idea he wanted to top it. And as you said, he probably thought he could do the same, or he could replicate something like this in Iran. I mean, yeah, but lots of people knew it's not possible,
One
right?
thing that's really ironic is only, I think only Trump could have done this. I think the chance of war with Iran would ironically be less likely under an establishment president, like either if Kamala Harris became president or any of the past presidents, including like neocons like George Bush. Like, I don't even think George Bush would have gone to war with Iran. I don't think Obama would. I don't think Joe Biden would. Ironically, Trump, who was supposedly anti-establishment, was the one who could have who pulled that off.
Yeah, but now he can't get out, right? And that's the
Yeah,
mistake.
he's
Like
stuck.
he thought he could pull it off. He probably thought. I mean, I remember at the February 28th, they said, "Oh, it's like a 3-day operation," and now it's been over 2 months, and it's not nearly over, because there's no off ramp for Trump, and that's why he lost it like a couple of weeks ago when he said, "Open the fucking strait, you bastards!" You know, like on Easter
Yeah,
Sunday, he said this.
sounded
It's like
like
what?
a
And then
comic book villain or a total
and
lunatic.
then he said, "Praise Allah," you know, at the end. It's like, I mean, it's deranged, right? I mean, he's clearly mentally not well. There's clearly something wrong with him. And I think right now he's losing patience, but he really doesn't know what to do, because everything he says is absolute nonsense. He constantly contradicts himself. He makes absurd statements. He keeps saying that the Iranians have no navy anymore, they have no missiles anymore, they've been completely defeated. But you have numerous reports by high-profile agencies that say the exact opposite, right? That not even half of Iran's weapons are depleted, and the Air Force is still, you know, fairly intact, as is the Navy, as the presence of all these speedboats in the Strait of Hormuz proof. And I mean, the Strait of Hormuz, I mean, it's all about the Strait of Hormuz now, because On the first day, the February 28th, first day of the attack, Trump like gave this like announcement, and he said, "Now is the time for the Iranian people to rise up against the evil regime."
Well, what he admitted to is
Boom.
actually the U.S. Was arming the protesters, and you should obviously, that's something that's usually top secret, but he has like this verbal diarrhea, and he admitted that. So basically, the U.S. was trying, not trying to overthrow the government, but they were trying to get the anti-regime Iranian protesters killed so they could create justification for the invasion.
Yeah, no, I get, well, I agree with you, but I think there, I mean, there's no real invasion though, right? Because you cannot topple a government just by bombing a country. You'd actually need to be on the ground, which is virtually impossible. And he probably thought that enough people, I mean, he and his administration probably thought that maybe enough people would rise up, the anti-government people in Iran, and maybe topple the regime, maybe like a civil war situation or something. But I think now the opposite has happened, because I think a lot of the people that were against the Iranian government, that were protesting the Iranian government, are probably behind the government now because of US and Israeli actions, the indiscriminate bombing of civilians, especially little children. I mean, if I was a protester, I would think twice about supporting the United States after I see what they did to, like, I don't know, schoolgirls and other civilian targets.
And I think
So
it's a real sense of
completely
betrayal
counterproductive.
because, like, what Israel did in Gaza, I think that was pretty disgusting. But you could make a hypothetical argument that the Gazans already despise Israel. But I think with Iran, like, there's a sense
You
of
cannot, no,
betrayal
sorry,
that you're
yeah.
bombing people who were initially liked America, or in some cases were even like friendly to Israel. Like, there's a
I don't
real
think,
violation of
yeah.
the reciprocity principle.
I know. I think it's a minority in Iran, though. I don't believe this Western propaganda that the
Well,
majority of
I
Iranians
think
are
now
somehow
it is
against
because
this
of the war,
government,
but
even
I
before the
think in the
war.
past it was different.
No, I don't think so. I think the majority of people in Iran were pretty much behind the government, or at least not against the government. I don't believe this narrative that before the war, supposedly like a large percentage of Iranians were somehow against the government. I don't buy it. I haven't seen evidence for this.
Well, I mean, there's like a dias. I mean, the diaspora, like the people you meet in California are, but they're so far removed from.
Yeah, but
They've been here a long time and they're.
you have these people here in Germany. Like last week, I went to Frankfurt to go shopping with my family, and they had another one of those pro-Shah demonstrations in downtown Frankfurt, where they were like Israeli flags, American flags, the Iranian flag with a lion, and like portraits of the Shah. It's just completely silly. Nobody takes them seriously, and they don't represent the people that actually live in Iran. And by the way, I would just like to point out another thing. The word regime, right, is another one of those propaganda words like racism and genocide, because it's always the Iranian regime, right, the Putin regime, and but the West has governments, the villains always have regimes. It's very silly. And by the way, this goes both ways, because I know that the Iranians, they always call Israel the Zionist regime or the Trump regime. You know, I mean, it's all like it's a propaganda
I
term.
remember when Biden was president, Trump supporters started referring to the U.S. government under Biden as the regime.
Yeah, I know. That's what I mean. It's a propaganda term. I just don't like it. That's why I never say Iranian regime. I just say Iranian government, because I don't see like what makes a regime anyway. What is a regime? A regime is basically a government that the Western powers don't like, that the hegemon disapproves of. And I think another thing to keep in mind with this whole conflict in Iran is that I think the Trump administration, is desperately trying to keep up the unipolar world order. It is desperately trying to prevent the rise of the multipolar world, but I think it's totally failing in this respect, because it is totally losing the conflict in Iran. Iran has the upper hand, clearly. And every time you hear Trump saying that the Iranians, they just called us, they want to negotiate, I think it's the other way around, obviously. I think it's the Americans that are constantly begging the Iranians to negotiate because they want an off-ramp, but the Iranians are not giving them one. And this is basically destroying the power of
No,
the
I do think
people,
actually,
right?
well, Netanyahu wants to see Iran totally destroyed, but I think with Trump, like Trump, I think he's proven himself to be a total idiot. and totally out of touch with reality. But I don't think he personally desires a forever war. I think he wants an exit from this. But there's this professor from, I think, the University of Chicago, a military professor named Robert Pape, and he's, I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he's talking about how Iran is winning the escalation trap because basically, if America withdraws or doesn't do anything, doesn't basically withdraws or doesn't do anything, then Iran controls the Strait of Hormuz and they can charge toll, and that will make Iran much wealthier and more geopolitically powerful. He says they'll become the re they could become a regional power and a fourth power after the U.S., China, and Russia. But then, if the U.S. attacks, then Iran will retaliate by attacking all the oil infrastructure in the Gulf Arab countries. So the U.S. is in an escalation trap, either way. And I think what's sort of going on now is there's been talk of a ceasefire, but it's kind of bullshit. But there is like this stalemate. So basically, Iran, the U.S. has a blockade on Iran's blockade. So they're trying to. So basically, both sides are kind of holding off on directly fighting, but they're hoping that the other side will get economically harmed more. And I think the way I see it is, I don't see how long that can last. Like, will things basically de-escalate and Iran will just control the strait, or will this provoke further escalation? Because I know Iran is like they're moving oil through Pakistan by rail to China, but it is also possible that America's naval blockade could damage Iran, so Iran retaliates again against the Gulf. So I don't really know if the status quo will be continued or if they'll escalate again. But there is what Robert Pape talks about, like America is stuck in this escalation trap.
Definitely, and there's really no way out for the Americans, as you so clearly stated. I mean, the Iranians are already in charge of the Strait of Hormuz, and they're already charging ships money, I think $2 million to pass the straits, and they don't accept U.S. dollars. They want to be paid in the Chinese currency or Bitcoin. And this will continue, obviously. And a lot of business that is now being conducted with Iran from countries that are still friendly with Iran is also done without the US dollar. So I think this conflict will spell the end of the petrodollar, basically, which will seriously undermine American power in the world, will basically fracture the American empire, because a lot of countries that are not directly involved in this conflict, they see what's going on and they can clearly notice that the United States is basically a paper tiger, right? It says a lot, but it doesn't really do a lot. And the people can see that what Trump is saying is just utter bullshit and total nonsense, constant lies and evasions. And then he already lost face anyway, because how many ultimatums did he give? I think like four or five times he said like, okay, if by this date like Iran doesn't agree to this and this demand, then we'll like destroy their civilization, we'll do this, we'll do that. And every single time the Iranians did not agree to any of the demands. And it's just, yeah, okay, well, ultimatum has come and gone. We'll just extend it because the Iranians are thinking about negotiating now. It's like, it's totally ridiculous. It lost all credibility, in my opinion. And it's also market manipulation, some people say, because
Oh,
he
yeah, like the tweets, Trump saying
right.
he's going to do a deal, and that's market manipulation
Yeah,
to calm the stock markets. Because what happened
what
basically with oil prices is oil prices were being kept down because of speculators assuming that the war was going to de-escalate. But now the actual like shortages are hitting. So like where I am, I think before the war, gas prices per gallon were slightly less than five, were a little less than $5. And no, they were more like $4, and now it's up to about $6, and it now like there's actual the physical shortages are hitting. And I guess it's
Right. Yeah,
probably
exactly.
in Europe where you are, the petrol prices are probably going up even more.
Yeah, actually not that much right now. Like like diesel, for example, was like 1 euro 70 cents for per liter. And one liter is like a quarter gallon, basically. I mean, gas is much more expensive in Europe than in the US anyway. So I mean, €1.70, it's almost 1 to 1, like I think 180 in dollars before the war, and now it's like 220 or something, or 230. Like 2 weeks ago it was at 250. So it keeps going up and down. I'm not really sure why. And the German government just introduced some sort of emergency measure where they're gonna subsidize gasoline basically through removing some tax. So it will be automatically 17 cents cheaper than it should be, right? So 17 cents will be covered by the government starting from tomorrow, actually.
I think the
So,
US
yeah.
will eventually lose the petrodollar. I don't know if that will happen this year or a decade from now. Who knows the timeline, but it's probably inevitable. But for the short term, the US does have, so, I mean, prices are on a global market unless there's like an energy ban for exports. But the US does have some degree of energy independence, and Russia is definitely, Russia's benefiting from this crisis, which is ironic because the neocons also hate Russia, and Russia is an Iran ally. And China doesn't have much oil, but they do have large reserves. And but Europe, I mean Europe and East Asian countries like Japan and South Korea, they're getting like screwed over the most, as well as they're losing. The US is relocating all their missile interceptors from East Asia to the Middle East, and that's weakening America's geopolitical power encountering China, so by relocating all the missiles interceptors to the Middle East. And I mean, then you have that issue where the US is running low on interceptors. So you have these they cost I mean they cost just billions of dollars, and Iran's able to do damage to them using these really cheap drones that cost like 20,000 to make. So that does show you like the US is fighting the war in the 20th century, and Iran, despite only having a fraction of the military budget, has actually gained like an upper hand with like asymmetrical warfare. But I think it will, I don't think, I think it will definitely cause tremendous damage to the American empire and end US hegemony. But at the same time, like a lot of other countries are going to be harmed because it's going to be like a global economic crisis. I don't know. I mean, I don't know how bad it's going to get. Some people are getting hyperbolic and saying it's like a Great Depression, but people were saying similar stuff about COVID and the Russia-Ukraine war, and that didn't quite happen. So I'm not, I mean, who knows? But I think there will be some major economic pain that will be felt globally.
No, I completely agree with you. And if you talk about Russia is like benefiting from this tremendously at the moment, simply because of the oil price, because the oil prices are rising like crazy. And of course, Russia is benefiting from this because it's a major oil exporter. So I think the Russian government is to some extent quite happy about the situation right now, I should say, because they're making a lot more money than before. But as you said, yeah, I mean, because it doesn't just affect oil and gas, but also other products that are connected to it, like fertilizers, for example. And then, I mean, you hear these scenarios where you have like ma what you will have mass starvation in Africa, for example, because they won't have enough fertilizers to grow enough food, basically. And it's already supposedly the case. We'll just see the results. I
It'll
mean,
cause a massive refugee
couple
crisis
soon.
into Europe on top
Well,
of the
that's the
war.
other thing, right? Because like millions and millions of Africans, they won't have enough to eat, and where will they go? They will all go to Europe, of course. I mean, that's a given, naturally. I mean, they probably would have come anyway, because I mean, they're simply because I mean, I just read an article actually a couple of weeks ago that the country of Nigeria alone, I mean, just the country of Nigeria, every year more people are born in Nigeria than in all of Europe,
I heard that too.
including Russia, right?
Like
And
it's
that's
going to
just
surpass
amazing.
the US in population by like the by at least 2040.
They're rapidly expanding, rapidly growing. And obviously, I mean, a lot of these Africans are going to move north. They're going to move to Europe, and Europe will not be able to resist. And it won't resist anyway for ideological reasons. And even if it did have I don't know, say a patriotic or nationalist governments, they still wouldn't be able to resist because of the sheer mass and the sheer force. Because if you think about it, nobody is really interested in stopping mass immigration, not even the Trump administration, right? I mean, Trump kept talking about mass deportations, but I don't really see
Well,
mass.
he did. In Trump's defense, he did secure the border. But with his mass deportations, it's actually a pretty big disaster because it's like the worst. It's the worst of both worlds because what he's doing is he's deporting a small number of people, which is making a minimal impact. But he's doing this kind of performative cruelty, which basically it energizes the left, and it definitely causes harm. For the Republicans with Latino swing voters, so it's like the worst of both worlds, where you get this backlash from like the performative cruelty, but you don't really have you the demographic impact is so minimal, and the number yeah because the numbers Trump is deporting are pretty small.
Yeah, very small. And as you said, it's mostly theater, like dragging out some, I mean, the ICE agents dragging out some cooks from Mexican restaurants in front of the TV cameras. But I mean, if the Trump administration, actually any government, were serious about stopping illegal immigration, they would penalize the businesses that hire illegals.
Right, and they're
But
not doing
harsh,
that.
but harshly, to set an example. But they don't do this. They don't do this. And why don't they do it? Because everybody benefits from it. Everybody makes money of it. That's why nobody's serious. It's the same in Europe, obviously. I mean, if you have like all these farms in California, for example, or Texas, that hire these illegals to pick the fruit or whatever. I mean, if you punish them, I mean, super harshly, set an example. Then you would the incentives would dry up, and that's what should be done. It's the same with like why can illegal well, how is it possible for illegals to send their kids to school? How is it even possible? Don't you need paperwork to go to school? Well, I mean, how can they get driver's licenses? How is that possible? It's
Well,
all very
California tried
well.
to ban that back in the 90s, and it was struck down by federal courts.
Yeah, it's just very odd though, right? So that's what it tells me. Nobody's really serious about it, and because of the conflict in Iran. I mean, the situation, especially for, as you said, for Europe, will get much, much
So
worse.
I have a bit of a nuanced view. It is some people are predicting the I mean I some people are predicting the total end of the American Empire, but it's also possible that I actually think Europe will be, and countries like Japan and South Korea will be harmed much worse. I think what America will do, I don't think it will collapse as an empire, but it will sort of move away from the Eastern Hemisphere and become like a regional power over the Western Hemisphere. That's
No,
what I
it will give.
predict.
Well, of course, obviously. I mean, because you have in the multipolar world, I mean, you have a sort of a Darwinian multipolarity. It's not going to be some hippie multipolarity where all of humanity is going to hold hands like walking across a meadow. You're going to have different civilization states, meaning empires, in competition with each other. The difference between the multipolar future and the situation now, though, is the unipolar world is that we will not have one empire dictating its will to the rest of the world, but we will, as you said, we will have regional powers, regional empires that will have a sphere of influence in their own hemisphere. That's why, of course, the United States will still be extremely powerful, even if it will not be the global hegemon anymore. And it will still tell, I don't know, South America, Latin America, what to do because it's the dominant power in the Western Hemisphere, in both North and South America, obviously. And but it's the same with Russia, right? I mean, Russia is an empire and it also has a sphere of influence, and Ukraine is clearly in Russia's sphere of influence, and it does not want Western encroachment in its sphere of influence, just like the United States during the Cuban Missile Crisis doesn't want Russian missiles in Cuba or, I don't know, Russian bases in Mexico. I mean, it would vehemently oppose this, even militarily.
Oh yeah.
So I don't understand the hypocrisy, like why people complain what's happening in Ukraine, because it's clearly in Russia's sphere of influence, and NATO or Western encroachment, in my opinion, is akin to what happened in the Cuban Missile Crisis. It's a direct parallel. Also, the
So
double.
I guess if like with the Russia-Ukraine war, like there's this kind of like there's like the libertarian like non-aggression principle. From that perspective, like Russia's the aggressor, but then geopolitically, Russia could say like it's analogous to China putting military bases in Mexico attacking the US, so there's different angles. But I think of the war, but I mean, it is a total. I mean, I still think whatever you think of it, but it is a huge travesty. A tragedy in Ukraine's been totally destroyed, and with Russia, I think on economics, Russia is benefiting on the oil issues, and their economy seems to be doing okay. But they still lost a massive numbers of soldiers, and it's still, I mean, it is catastrophic in that regard as a human tragedy for both Russia and Ukraine. But I think it's also been demographically has caused a lot of harm to Russia too.
Oh, absolutely, I agree. Definitely. I just don't understand the double standard, though, right? I mean,
Yeah, of
because
course.
like you have the United States and Israel attacking a sovereign country, Iran, completely unprovoked, in my opinion, and really treacherous and really, I don't know, just like villainous almost, like during negotiations, right? Which is really, I mean, how can any country in the world trust the United States after this? Like, why would any country go
Because
negotiate
after
negotiate enter
some of
negotiations with the US? You, I mean, it again totally discredited itself, and it's a double standard, targeting civilians in Tehran, basically indiscriminate terror bombing, but then complaining
and the
about
double, yeah, like the
Russia
double
and
tap too,
Ukraine,
that's
right?
something that makes it pretty blatant, the double tack tactic that Israel's done, because it will use there's no ambiguity. It makes it appear like totally intentional.
No, I completely agree. But it's also the reaction from the European Union. Like, they immediately sanctioned Russia and passed laws, like in Germany, where it is now illegal to justify an offensive war or to say that an offensive war was somehow good. And it, of course, relates to Russia's attack on Ukraine. But I think if you in Germany said that you think it's cool that America attacked Iran, you probably would not get prosecuted under that law, because it's clearly aimed at Russia only. That's why. But the double standard, especially in the global South, is glaring. I mean, all the countries can see it now, that the West is basically. The West says one thing, but does the exact opposite.
So if you look a bit at back, go back in history a bit, Iran, there was the whole issue with the U.S. installing the Shah and resentment over that. But even there was like a period. So after 9/11, Iran did offer sort of like an olive branch to the U.S. And there were, I do remember back then, there were these candlelight vigils in Tehran to show solidarity with Americans. And then Iran actually helped. Actually, Iran actually helped America a bit in Afghanistan because they had a common enemy with the Taliban. And Iran, I read somewhere, I don't know how, if this is true or not, but Iran offered America a deal to ally against the Saudis because they were at the time the 9/11 hijackers were Saudi, and Iran viewed Saudi Arabia as an adversary. But so Iran wasn't going out of their way to be hostile. So I think it's pretty clear that Iran, and then with Iran and Israel, so I don't even think, because even with Iran and Israel, they were allies under the Shah, but then even under the Iran-Iraq war in the 80s, the Israelis actually were more against Saddam. And obviously Iran did benefit from the Iraq war because the Iraq became more Shia dominated. But with Iran and Israel, I don't even think Iran was even that anti-Israel. I just think they supported the Palestinians to gain some degree of geopolitical leverage because Shias were the minority in the Sunni-dominated Middle East. But things just really escalated between Israel and Iran. So it is, I think what we said at the beginning of the show, it is about Israel, but Iran didn't even go out of its way to antagonize America because there were like those past examples when Iran did offer like olive branches. And then obviously you had the nuclear deal under Obama, which seemed to be successful.
Well, regarding the nuclear deal that Obama made with Iran, I think it's a special case, because I mean, he made the deal with Iran, but then Trump, in his first administration, he basically just ripped it up and said, "Well, it's null and void. I don't like it." And there we go, right? And Sergei Lavrov, the Russia's foreign minister, I mean, he aptly put it when he said that the United States is basically agreement incapable. And this is just another point because, I mean, you have the Iranian government making a deal with the US government under Obama, signing this treaty, thinking, all right, it's a good deal for us. We can agree. Great. Now we're all set. But then again, 4 years later, you have Trump and he just rips it up and now it means nothing. So again, like I said earlier, like how can anybody, like any country, negotiate or make deals or sign treaties with the United States if the treaties are not honored across administrations? Because apparently, like a treaty that you sign with the United States government is only valid for a maximum of 4 years, maybe eight, right? If the same president is reelected, but not beyond that, not beyond the current president, which is crazy. And it's also when Trump talks about the Ukraine conflict, he keeps saying it's Biden's war. It's not my war. It's Biden's war. And it's like, but it's in reality, it's the United States war, and you're the U.S. president, so it
Right,
is your
right.
war, right? It seems to me as I mean. It seems to me that every time there's a new administration, a new president, it's all of a sudden like a completely new country that has nothing to do with the previous 4 years at all. There's like no continuity, and I keep saying this, it's like a bipolar system, and I mean this in a clinical sense. Yes, because it's the same with immigration. I mean, we can go back to that topic real quick because it fits neatly here. Because as you said, right, okay, so the border is fairly secure now under Trump, supposedly. But then the next president will probably be Gavin Newsom. I mean, it's my bet at least in 2028. And I mean, he's pretty liberal. He's from California, the governor. If he becomes president, which is very likely, or if not him, it will probably be another
Yeah, he
Democrat.
will squander
Yeah,
everything Trump has done good.
but that is my point. So
Because Trump has
what good does it
done
do?
some, he's
What
done some good
good what
things,
good does it
but it's all
do?
squandered.
Yeah, if there's no continuity. So I mean, Trump closes the border. The border's all secure. Everything's sort of cool. But then the next Democrat, he will just open the borders again. Everybody will come right back in
I
from.
think if Kamala Harris became president, we would be in a much better position.
How so?
Okay, so she would probably she would open the border to some degree. She would open the border to some degree. There would be a lot of bad things, but the thing is we would get that inevitably. But at least if Kamala Harris was president, we could hope that I think she would be ineffective and incompetent. But we there would be that hope of like 2028. But I think this is like the worst case political scenario imaginable because the right, like the right and nationalism in America, and MAGA or anything remotely associated with the right or nationalism or populism is totally discredited.
Yeah, absolutely. It's ruined now. It's become toxic. That's what I mean. I mean, Trump, after the midterm elections, he will probably just become a lame duck. Maybe he'll even get impeached. Who knows? But he will definitely lose power.
And
And there will
these MAGA
definitely.
people, they're so delusional. They're coping about JD Vance becoming president. Like, how fucking idiots can they be?
Yeah, this will never happen. I mean, just a few months ago, like 2, 3 months ago, well, before this whole Iran debacle, I was very optimistic about the United States. I was almost euphoric. I was like, yeah, I mean, Trump is not perfect, right? I mean, nobody's perfect, but what he's doing is great. It's just a symbol of the right, not just in the United States, but
Well, I guess like
globally,
one thing
especially
about
across the world.
immigration is
Sorry.
I'm actually more, I think you touched on the immigration crisis of overpopulation of Africa. That's why I'm more pessimistic about Europe, because Europe is facing this existential crisis with the population explosion in Africa. What's with the US? I actually predict with the US is that a lot of people will return. Because like a Mexico, a lot of Mexico is actually decent. Like I think with, and same with people like H-1Bs from India, I think that automation will slow down a lot of immigration to the US and things could actually be okay at some point in the future. But that Europe, with Europe and Africa, that situation, that doesn't apply.
Well, I completely agree. And as I said, I was quite optimistic about Trump. And just because he had a lot of clout also in Western Europe with like the Patriots and the nationalist parties. And I thought like Vance as 48 would be great, you know, because MAGA should have become dynastic to have some sort of continuity for long-term change in the United States and then in the West as a whole as a result. But because of this Iran debacle, the Republicans will probably lose the midterms. And Trump will basically be, well, like I said, like a lame duck. He will not have much power, and they will definitely not be Vance as the next president. I'm quite sure of it. I mean, there probably won't even be a Republican president. I think pretty sure it'll be a Democrat. And
Oh, for
and
sure.
as you said, it's the worst scenario imaginable because the right is completely discredited, not just in the United States though, but also in Western Europe
Oh
as a
yeah, Viktor Orban
right.
lost for being associated with Trump,
Yeah,
and then
but
also.
I'm not sure he lost because of that. I mean, it's probably one of the reasons, but I mean there are other reasons from what people in
And I
Hungary
think it will
tell
strengthen
me.
the left in Europe too.
Right. Yeah, no, it's
I have
all
no idea.
possible,
Like, do you think the
right?
AfD is damaged by it in Germany?
Well, AfD is really it's really soaring in the polls, though. I mean, right now I think it's at 28%, and it's 2 points above the Christian Democrats, the party which is in power now. So, I'm talking about the polls, like who people would vote for if elections were to be held today. So it's all hypothetical, but in these hypothetical polls, the AfD is the number one party right now, at like 28%, which is just pretty high, right? I mean, the AfD is at its most popular ever, to be honest, right now. Because I think it a lot has to do with the fact, all I mean, not a lot, but partly because they're now distancing themselves more and more from the Trump administration. While before the Iran war, they were really close together, constantly visiting each other and so on. But I think all of this has slowed down a lot because of public perception. And I think Chupalla, he's one of the two leaders of the AfD, because you have Alice Weidel, the lesbian woman, with a Sri Lankan wife or girlfriend. And then you have Chupalla, he's the second leader, so they lead the party together. And Chupalla just said the other day, quite radical actually, he said that the United States should basically, I mean, the United States military should leave Germany, because Germany should not become involved in these, I don't know, what he calls illegal
And
wars, like
ironically, like you
war
could
against
make an
Iran.
accelerationist argument in favor of Trump for weakening the American empire. You could ironically make that argument, the case in favor of Trump for that.
Yeah, of course. I mean, some people make this argument. I've heard even people say, maybe tongue in cheek, that Trump is doing all this on purpose, like he's playing a sort of martyr, like losing the
Like
war
he's
in Iran,
destroying, like
but
the
on purpose.
one positive thing I will say about Trump is he's dismantling this entire phony veneer of like soft power that the American establishment has. So that is maybe one of the few positive things I will say about Trump.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree. At least he's very honest. And because, I mean, I've said this in several discussions with lots of people, that the Trump administration at least openly says what they're doing, because what they're doing is not really much different from previous administrations, except previous administrations couched it in certain liberal terms, like we want to bring freedom to the women, or democracy, or topple the new Hitler, and so on. But Trump
Like
just
he
said,
said, he explicitly
yeah,
said,
well,
we're
hold
going to
on, I'm
take
not
their
finished.
oil.
Wait, well, yeah, exactly, right? So he just said we want the oil. Just, I mean, it's very blunt, you know, which is very
Yeah.
refreshing, as you said. So, like, yeah, I completely agree, because that's all it is—power politics. Because international law clearly does not exist, and it has never existed. I mean, the whole Iran thing is a good example, because I mean, everybody says, oh, it's a violation of international law. I mean, that's what they said in Germany, a lot of politicians. But for some reason, there are no consequences, because the United States government is still allowing the US military to use the American air bases on German soil to attack sovereign countries, basically making Germany a party to the war, you know, because if Iran would use, like, I don't know, Iranian air bases in Canada to attack the United States, don't you think that the United States government would consider the Canadians culpable in this? I
Of
would say
course.
yes, obviously, right? I mean, it's the same with the British. I mean, they also use British bases to attack Iran. So, I mean, but all these countries, especially Britain and Germany and the other EU country,
And
and
obviously the
EU
Gulf
countries, they
countries.
constantly complain about, like, I don't know, a violation of international law, and it's, I mean, it needs to be upheld. And this is like, I mean, if there is such a thing as international law, which is questionable, well, but at least the concept, I guess, exists. I mean, the attack on Iran is a textbook case of a violation of international law. But I don't see condemnation of this attack in Europe. I mean, real condemnation on government levels in the European Union. I don't see sanctions, calls for sanctions against the United States. I don't see the Olympic Committee discussing excluding American athletes from the Olympic Games like they do with Russian athletes. So the double standard is just. So it's a blinding, like you need special glasses to even be able to comprehend or look at this double standard that is
So there
unfolding right now.
is like this Sunni versus Shia split, and Sunnis are dominant, Shias are the minority. So obviously Sunnis have this more, the extremists have, they have, well, they have Al-Qaeda, ISIS, Wahhabi, Salafist type terrorist groups. They have this dream of a greater caliphate, and the Saudis and Qataris and other various Gulf Arabs have been funding these Wahhabi mosques in Western Europe. But so obviously they're much worse. They're obviously the threat and the problem. But at the same time, like even so, I do think like some of these Gulf states, like Saudi Arabia, like their elite is becoming like less Islamic and more kind of decadent, like the West. So I used to consider the Gulf Arabs and the Saudis and Wahhabis to be a major adversary to Europe. But even with that, like I think Islamophobia in general kind of detracts from the inner issues in the West, where pretty much all our problems are, they're not so much these other groups. It's the political elites in the United States and Europe who are primarily to blame.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. I'm not what they call Islamophobic at all. I have nothing against Islam as a religion. I think, like,
I think you said have you been to some Muslim countries?
I've been to several Muslim countries, like Pakistan, for example, and
Because I think
Egypt
you were
and
saying
Turkey.
you're a, so Pakistanis have a really terrible reputation in the UK, but you were saying, and I think maybe a previous show we did in India, your impression of Pakistan was actually fairly positive.
Same with India or Egypt. A lot of Islamic country, Indonesia is another Islamic country I went to. I mean, they're very friendly, very polite, usually. I mean, I never had any issues. Felt pretty safe, I guess, walking around the streets, even at night. The same cannot be said of Western cities. And I don't understand this hatred of some people on the right for Islam. If you don't want your country swamped with, I don't know, foreigners or non-Europeans, I suppose, as a rightist, then why differentiate whether these people are Christians, Hindus, or Muslims? Because they say Islam is
Because I
incompatible
think Tommy
with
Robinson
European
in the
culture,
UK, he's very Islamophobic, but
right?
he's fine with mass immigration if it's Hindus or Nigerian Christians. He's just opposed to Muslims.
Right. Yeah. Well, exactly. They say it's it, well. I mean, what is the argument they use? It's supposedly it's incompatible with Western civilization. But I don't really see the incompatibility. Obviously, I mean, Islam is not a it has not properly been Europeanized yet. But I've actually had this discussion with a Muslim guy. I did a show once when we talked about Michel Houellebecq's, the French author's book Submission, which basically is sort of a prophetic novel which envisions an Islamic takeover of France in the future. But the interesting aspect of the book is that it's very ambiguous of whether the author thinks that's a good thing or a bad thing. Because my Muslim friend, for example, he thinks the book is like a utopian novel. It describes a future Islamic caliphate in Europe, and it looks just so beautiful. But then people on the right say it's a dystopian novel because we will all have to submit to an alien religion. So my question is, though, right? Because Christianity itself, like when it entered Europe centuries ago, was also alien to Europe. I mean, it's from the Middle East. It's a Middle Eastern religion, but it was thoroughly Europeanized because, and especially during the Middle Ages, with a lot of pagan elements, especially like the Catholic Church, right? With the veneration of the saints, the Mother Mary, like a fertility goddess almost, and the Easter with the Easter bunnies and the Easter eggs, again, fertility symbols. And I don't see why this. I mean, I'm not advocating any of this, but I don't see how, like, why this couldn't happen with Islam as well. I mean, if there's
I mean,
some
you
sort
have countries
of,
like
right?
Bosnia, which are indigenous European but Muslim.
Or Albania, right, is another one. I mean, yeah. So I mean, I can totally see centuries from now, like, once Islam has become the dominant religion in Europe because of mass immigration, I mean, it will not, I think it will not be the same Islam in Europe than the Islam in the Middle East. I mean, it will be the same religion, but it will certainly incorporate European elements, and it will become Europeanized, sort of like Christianity has over the years. I don't see why this wouldn't happen. So, I mean, and if it has to happen, then it will happen. It's not like we can really
Well,
prevent
but it
it,
would
right?
change the ethnic composition in a way that Christianity didn't.
Well, the ethnic composition will change regardless because of pure demographics. First of all, the birth rate is like so grotesquely low in Western Europe. Just today in Germany, in the newspaper, it's at its lowest in decades. Like it's like so low. Like I think it's like 1.1, and you need like 2.1 minimum just to replacement level, basically. So it's way below replacement level. So all it's like almost every generation, the native population is cut in half. So they're refusing to have children while the immigrants have a lot of children. And even if you close all the borders right now, you already have millions and millions of them inside of Europe. And a lot of them, a very large percentage, already have citizenship. So how will you ever get rid of them? You will not get rid of them. It's simply not realistic. I don't see how. I don't believe in this vision of remigration that all of a sudden we
So you
can
support
remove
something
all.
more like ethno-pluralism?
Well, I don't. Yeah. Well, I just see it as a more viable
So like
option, right?
different groups can have like semi-autonomy in different ethnic enclaves or
Well, sort
neighborhoods.
of, right? I mean, yeah. I mean, that's the idea of ethno-pluralism. I guess it's just
I
natural.
basically support that.
Well, it's the most realistic scenario, and it's also what people naturally tend to do. I mean, in the United States, I mean, I was in Los Angeles,
All
as
right.
like 2 years ago. And it's I considered it an ethno-pluralist city because you have all these different ethnic neighborhoods, like, I don't know, like Little Tokyo and Koreatown and the Hispanic neighborhoods, Chinatown, etc., where all these different ethnic groups congregate and they speak their language. They have their own lawyers, their own schools, their own offices, their own street signs,
I actually
supermarkets.
grew up when I was a kid, at least in the area. The Westwood, Little Tehran district, which is where all the upper class that was pro-Shah relocated to.
Oh wow,
I grew
okay,
up in that area.
interesting. Right. Yeah, would you consider Los Angeles an ethno-pluralist city, in your opinion?
For sure. I mean, there are some places where there's some degree of mix, like,
Of
but for the
course.
most part, you see balkanization.
Right.
What are your thoughts on this idea of Iran being like Indo-Aryan? Do you see Iranians, do you view them as cousins to Europeans, or do you feel that connection is fairly distant?
Well, I think it's fairly distant, but it's still there. So, I mean, I do feel it because I mean, I think Iranians are definitely closer in spirit and mentality to Europeans than Arabs are, for sure. Also because I mean, yeah, simply because of their heritage and they themselves, I mean, the Iranians, they know
I
it.
think they
They
do,
know
like
about
even
this.
Shia Islam, like with Catholicism, incorporates some like pagan pre-Islamic influences.
Yeah, I think for sure, and they definitely respect their, I mean, pagan ancestry, and I mean Zoroastrianism, for example, in Iran. They don't denigrate it, they don't deny it. So it's not like the iconoclastic Salafists, for example, or the ISIS people who smash the Buddha statues because it doesn't fit their Islamic worldview. I think the Iranians, they have great respect for their pre-Islamic history and pre-Islamic culture. And especially the I would say, yeah, as you said, the Indo-Aryan heritage for sure. I mean, the word Iran itself is derived from Aryan.
With Israel, you actually said you visited Israel and used to be a Zionist. But obviously, the current regime is, I mean, I don't support Netanyahu. I think he's totally psychotic. But with Israel, is interesting is the leftists attack Israel for being European colonialists. But I think Israel was maybe semi-sane when it was more like European and Ashkenazi, like in the 80s when you had like Yitzhak Rabin. I think like Israel's future is just because they're just going to be like just another Middle Eastern country and they're losing any Western connection. But I think there was maybe a window in the past when Israel could have been, or even Zionism could have been like semi-sane.
Well, that was the idea, right? Because I think, I mean, tear their
Because
hearts
the
for.
different, because like some of them, like I mean, I detest Netanyahu, but I do have maybe some affinity for some of like the old school, like German Jewish Zionists and like the Kibbutzim movement, like some of that stuff.
Well, you
But
have, yeah.
my overall view of Israel now is fairly negative.
Right. Yeah, well, I feel the same way, to be honest. If you look at the early Zionists, like basically the founder of Zionism, the Theodor Herzl, he was from the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and he even advocated. I mean, it was before the State of Israel existed, and but he propagated for the Jewish emigration to Palestine at the time. And he envisioned first he had the idea that Israel should be German speaking, right? He was not.
Oh,
He
yeah.
was not, yeah, he was not enamored of the idea of Hebrew because, like, he said, who the hell is going to study Hebrew, this dead language? And German is already a vibrant language. And because of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, you had a lot of Jews that already spoke German that were going to emigrate to Israel. So the majority would have been German speaking anyway. So that was the original idea.
And you
Well,
saying you've
I've
been
been
to
to, yeah,
Israel.
I've been to Israel. I was
I
staying
mean,
there.
there are definitely positive elements. Like it is,
Oh,
there are
that's
things to
right.
respect about it because they
No,
have
no, yeah.
they do have like high fertility, but it's a very urban, but also urban, and they have a lot of vitality. I mean, I don't support their policies, but there are like on domestic issues, there are things to respect about it.
Absolutely, no, I completely agree. I mean, I have to say, it's a very civilized country. It's fairly clean, it's very sophisticated. I mean, culturally, it's as you said, it's very
I
Western,
guess
it's
it's
also
sort of a
very
hybrid.
European.
It's kind of, I view it as like a hybrid of European and Middle Eastern, which you can make that case about like Western Turkey too.
Yeah, I see the comparison. Yeah, for sure. But I think I'm not sure. I mean, Zionism as the idea itself was a return to the Holy Land. I think it could have worked, maybe to some extent, if they had not embraced the idea of imperialism,
What should have
which.
been, I think, like with. Like Martin Buber is this Jewish mystic who was kind of a left Zionist, but he actually advocated something for Israel that would be more like ethno-pluralism. And I think that would have been the best case scenario.
Yeah, but I
But
think
obviously that's not going to work out today.
well, it's not. And as you said, demographically, like Israel is turning into I mean, in
Like it's ultra
ethnically,
ultra Orthodox and
right?
Mizrahi and the more traditional secular Ashkenazi populations being marginalized.
Yeah, exactly. So ethnically speaking, it's becoming more Middle Eastern, which I think I suppose is a logical it's a logical consequence since they settled in the Middle
All
East
right.
and they're basically being absorbed by the Middle East, which is just the way things work, I suppose, because a lot of people argue that Israel, when it was still a sort of European sort of white settler state, I mean, if you consider Ashkenazi Jewish white people, which they clearly are, right? Like as so a lot of
Well,
people
I'm
consider
like
Israel
one
like a
sixteenth. Well, I'm like
yeah
1/16 Jewish.
Right. Well, anyway, a lot of people consider Israel a white European settler state, a sort of like alien element in the Middle East, and that's why it drew
I.
so much hostility from its neighbors, which I completely understand, right? Because because they also, I mean, ethnically cleansed the
Right.
Palestinians after the founding of Israel. So and then set up their sort of like apartheid system, some people say. Yeah, so now it's changing demographically and it's being absorbed by its surroundings, and it's sort of like when you have like this office complex in the middle of the forest that some bank built for seminars, but then it's abandoned for several decades
Right.
and the forest
And I
completely
think you'll
takes it over.
probably get the more cosmopolitan European Israelis will probably immigrate to the West, and it will
Oh, of
just
course, right.
and then Israel will just become more extreme and more isolated from the West. I could even see Israel eventually maybe even forming an alliance with China and Russia, and then just to, as more younger Americans are less pro-Israel, like I think Israel and the West may part ways, and I could see Israel forming an alliance between, I mean, the UAE maybe, but they're collapsing, but maybe between like India, Russia, and China.
Well, Russia, I can definitely see because Russian is the number one language after Hebrew now in Israel. I mean, Putin said that the other day, like, how can Russia really be against Israel? I mean, there's so many Russians that live in Israel, meaning the Russian Jews that emigrated to Israel. It's really noticeable. I mean, it used to be English, I suppose, after Hebrew, but now it's definitely Russian. Like, more people speak Russian now than English in Israel, very noticeably so. Because of, yeah, I would say mass immigration from the former Soviet Union. And yeah, so I think there are a lot of cultural ties and even ethnic ties
Because the
between Russia
Kibbutzim
and
was
Israel.
influenced by that German Volk movement, which ironically influenced both Hitler but also the American hippies. You see that connection?
Sorry, which German book?
The Kibbutzim in Israel were influenced by the 19th century kind of like German back to the land movement,
Ah, yeah,
which
right. Yeah,
ironically
no, for
influenced both the
sure.
Nazis and
Right.
hippies.
No, well, yeah, I heard that, right? Yeah, possibly. I mean, it was very popular at the time because it wasn't just the Nazis, it was lots of other movements that had this, I know, romantic idea. And I guess, yeah, the kibbutzim picked up on it. And apparently, like, even in the Third Reich, like, before the Nazis really started persecuting the Jews, but the Third Reich was already in existence, you already had inside, like, Nazi Germany, like, these paramilitary Jewish organizations, because I suppose the German Jews were not allowed to join the Hitler Youth and the German youth movement, so they set up their own Jewish ones, but along similar lines. I mean, I just recently read an article about this with like photographs. It was quite interesting to me, actually.
We're at the end of the show. Before I wrap up, Constantine, do you want to plug any website, or you also have a new book out? I think it's this one, The Future of White Americans. Do you want to plug that book and any other projects or websites that you
Yeah,
have?
sure. So, well, as you just said, I just came out with a new book like 2 weeks ago. It's called The Fate of White America.
Oh, sorry, The Fate of White America.
Yeah, no problem. It's anyway, yeah, you should check it out. It's on Amazon. You can order it. Yeah, I discussed it also on some other podcasts in more detail. Basically, it's again like, what is the fate of white America? I mean, there are different scenarios, and I explore them in the book. So, yeah, check it out. I have my own personal Substack, eurosiberia.net, on which I post articles once or twice a week about philosophy, history, literature, whatever tickles my fancy at the time. And then I'm also the director of Multipolar Press, a new
So you're no
publishing
longer
company.
doing Arctos.
Yeah, no, I stopped working for Arctos last year in September. I have my own publishing house now called Multipolar Press, and published several books already. Well, like The Fate of White America is one of them. Also published a new abridged version of The Decline of the West. So instead of 1,200 pages, it's 250 pages. The abridgment was done by me with a lot of explanatory footnotes and abridged sections between the chapters. And a preface also that elaborates on the content. And then also I published Oswald Spengler's doctoral thesis about the Greek philosopher Heraclitus, which is actually quite popular, the first English translation, and the only one right now that you can order as a book. Yeah, and then I published another book of mine called Multipolar Galaxies: Star Wars as a Myth of Civilizational Rebirth, in which I discuss George Lucas's first six movies and portray George Lucas as sort of like the American Homer that created like this whole new mythology. But I compare it to what's going on right now, with a shift from the unipolar world to the multipolar world in the real world. And yeah, anyway, and then I published a science fiction novel called Ultra Heavy by Tim Kirby. He's probably the most famous American who lives in Russia right now, has his own podcast, and he's also a pro football player for the Russian team. But he's an American citizen, so he wrote this science fiction novel. So sort of also Warhammer 40,000 geopolitical galactic empire adventure stuff. And yeah, and then I have a website, multipolarpress.com, on which I feature a variety of different authors that discuss this hot topic right now.
Konstantin von Hofmeister, it's been a great show. Thank you so much for being on.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. Anytime. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for tuning in. You can follow Robert Stark on his Substack at robertstark.substack or on his website at starktruthradio.com. See you next time.